It's LA Podcast. Welcome, Scott Frazier.
Welcome to
the
me,
show. To yes, welcome to you. You never welcome me. I thought I would welcome you for once.
Well, I'm definitely not going to welcome you now because I feel like I just entered your house.
New conference room. New recording location. The goal, I think, should be to record in a different place every week.
Traveling podcast.
And then by the end, we'll have a complete sonic archive of the entire city.
I think NPR does that already.
Just gathering room tone from different places. And then we can sell the room tone to other podcasts.
The sound of LA.
We recorded a segment earlier this week about the search for a new chief of the LAPD. Charlie Beck is retiring. The police commission was choosing between a number of candidates. So we recorded a segment speculating about what kind of person they might choose to be a candidate to send to the mayor. They usually send three choices to the mayor's office. And then like 2 days later, they did make their selections, right, sent their choices to the mayor's office.
All our work invalidated.
The segment went directly into the trash. Then the mayor broke with tradition and said, I know I promised to reveal who the three candidates were that I was choosing between. And Garcetti said, no, this time I'm going to keep them a secret until I make my final decision. Or, and I guess never say who the candidates were.
Right. Just to set up a little bit. So originally, the LAPD, once Charlie Beck announced he was retiring, he's supposed to retire by the end of June.
Yeah.
The position had, I believe it was 31 applicants. So considerably more than the LA Unified search that we talked about.
31 applicants, right, for to be chief of the LAPD.
Predominantly people from within the department. Also some national candidates. The San Francisco chief of police was one of them.
Contrast that with LAUSD, which had four candidates, then two dropped out. So they had two candidates, and only one of the four was from LAUSD.
And only one of the four met the criteria of not being from USD, the LAUSD. So
yeah, that's
they,
right.
They went with that one.
They went, yeah, that's right. So people on the outside might probably think that both the LAPD and LAUSD are institutions with a lot of problems. But at least internally, and for like people in the city, they agree seemingly that LAUSD has a lot of problems because they didn't want anybody from LAUSD to run that department. But LAPD, they want basically, you know, four more years or whatever of Charlie Beck.
Essentially just continuity with what Chief Beck has been doing.
Yeah.
So back to Garcetti.
Tangent. I just have to go on a tangent about Chief Beck. He is like a few weeks from retirement. And there was kind of an interesting spin on the police movie cliche of like being just about to retire and then something truly awful happens to you. Usually in a police movie, it's a they get shot. But in this case, Charlie Beck went to work with like 2 weeks left to retire.
Just one more job to do.
And he got what seemed to be human remains thrown in his face. The aunt of Wakeisha Wilson, who the LAPD said committed suicide in their custody in 2016. The family has a lot of questions about how she died. Her aunt went to a public LAPD meeting.
There were Black Lives Matter protesters in attendance, as there often are at police commission meetings. Probably every single one for the past year, at least, they're there, and they were in I guess the front row, and
and they threw a substance in his face, and that he did quote ingest some of it. Gotta be the worst thing that has happened to him in his tenure as chief, and he was so close. He was almost out.
We were kind of talking about this in private. We were talking about whether or not some of the pressure that Beck has faced regarding his handling of police shootings, regarding beyond shootings, the treatment of African-American Angelenos by the police has been a factor in his decision to retire, which came relatively abruptly.
Pretty suddenly.
A couple months ago.
It also happened to occur the same day that I realized that I was blocked by the LAPD's Hollywood Twitter account.
Right. And you made that public. And then all of a sudden.
And then the next day, he retired. And at the time, I definitely thought.
It's causal.
That
it's
I had causal. 100%. Of the responsibility for
Charlie Beck retires in disgrace after popular podcast host announces he's blocked by their Twitter,
which happened because I had criticized the commander of the Hollywood division because I had found out that he follows a lot of racist alt-right Twitter accounts. Followed, he has since unfollowed them.
Oh, that's good.
Because someone
problem solved.
Someone has to go through people's follower list. Some brave citizen journalist. So to get back on track, Garcetti says, "I'm not announcing the candidates who the police commission picked.
They've narrowed it down to three. Yes. You don't get to know who."
I hear that. I reach back into the trash can, thinking maybe we can reuse our old segment, which doesn't reference any of these people specifically. Then, of course. Like 2 days later, the LA Times gets the list and publishes who the three candidates are. Why on earth
leads to the question, why would you do this?
Would Garcetti not do it not release the candidates in the first place, knowing that of course they were going to leak? So now you get the perception that you were trying to hide who they were.
In a really frivolous way, considering they're expected to be named by the beginning of June. I have no idea what is gained by not releasing who you're considering for the job.
Do you think it had something to do with there was a lot of discussion around having a female chief? As soon as Chief Beck retired, I remember Joe Buscaino and I think Noreen Martinez and some other city council people were like, now's the time. There's never been a female chief of police.
Yep.
Now's the time. And none of the three candidates are women.
I have no idea.
But Garcetti didn't pick them. Who's he protecting?
Right. They're nominated by the commission and chosen ultimately by Garcetti. I have no idea what is gained by not telling people the names.
Let's talk about the three candidates. This was published by Richard Winton, David Zanheiser, James Queeley, and Cindy Chang at the LA Times. Headline is a diverse trio of LAPD veterans, which they are racially diverse, as we said, not gender diverse. And they all have a lot of LAPD experience, and they all kind of came of age in the department, it says in the article, around the same time during the 92 riots.
Right.
The first one, Robert Arcos, is a third-generation Mexican-American. He's in charge of the Central Bureau, which is like downtown in Northeast LA. He would be first Latino police chief. I don't know how to pronounce the name of the second candidate, whose name looks like it could be Michael or Michelle.
I think it's Michelle.
M-I-C-H-E-L. Michelle.
We have determined. I mean,
at the very least, he doesn't want to be Michael Moore. He does. Right?
Probably not.
Okay. So he's Michelle Moore.
Which has a European verve to it, which it does, fitting.
Which is relevant. So he, to look at him, you would definitely think he was a white guy, but you would be wrong. He is listed in the department registrar or whatever as Hispanic because his father is Basque.
Well, there you go. First Hispanic chief.
First Hispanic chief. Imagine the celebration in the Little Bilbao neighborhood. LA, all the Pamplonans, how excited they would be to finally be represented with a Basque police chief. He, Michelle Moore, oversees the LAPD's patrol operations. He's Robert Arcos's boss, his like direct overseer. And then there's Bill Scott.
In San Francisco.
He's police chief in San Francisco.
Okay.
He's deeply involved in something going on there, which is a fight to have all police officers outfitted with tasers.
Right.
As opposed to not having tasers.
Okay, so yeah, they're just adding tasers.
Oh, they're not instead of guns.
Not taking guns away.
No, no, no.
Okay.
And I'm sure the argument is, well, if they have tasers, they have an option of force to use instead of guns.
Right. They can either use lethal force or a torture implement.
Occasionally lethal torture implement.
Yes.
If you have a heart condition, a taser could totally kill you.
Oh, totally.
And
a gun could totally torture you. But sure. Talking about primary usage. Yes.
And I think there's also a question of, like, would they use tasers instead of guns? Or would they more often use tasers instead of no weapon at all?
I mean, Oscar Grant was shot by a cop who said he was reaching for his taser or whatever. So,
and accidentally grabbed his gun.
So I don't know.
Yeah. So they should at least be on opposite sides. God. Yeah. Of the bell. That will save a lot of lives. There was somebody in the run. One of the final five people interviewed was a woman, Sandy Jo MacArthur, who retired 3 years ago as assistant chief, but she was, I guess, the highest ranking woman in LAPD at the time. And then the current highest ranking woman, Beatrice Girmala, did not apply.
Okay.
She was considered a real front runner for the job, didn't want it. Which is interesting because, as we said, a lot of people did. I don't know enough to have a guess about who would be picked. I know, interestingly, Michelle Moore was also in the... He was one of the three finalists when Charlie Beck was chosen.
Okay.
And he was actually the first ranked choice by the commission at the time. They rank the choices when they submit them. But Charlie Beck, I think it was second ranked. And he was picked instead. I don't know how these guys are ranked.
Yeah, that is interesting. I mean, you mentioned a lot of the two candidates that are from the LAPD have been there for a long time. Charlie Beck also has a long tenure in the LAPD.
Yeah.
Going back to, like we said, the Daryl Gates era of the early 90s.
Yeah. And Bill Scott was on the LAPD for a long time before he went to San Francisco.
Oh, okay. That's interesting. Yeah. So it is definitely interesting to see three candidates now in a time where policing is under heavy scrutiny in the media, on social media, and just part of a very large national conversation about how policing should be conducted. To see a very evident affirmation by civic leadership, the police commission, who was all elected or all nominated by Garcetti, and Garcetti himself in the continuity of the department for a period spanning back decades now. So definitely a vote of confidence from them in sort of the status quo, or at least a sign that they believe that this is a reasonable administration that they would like to see continue into the future.
Yeah. All three of them have been involved in police reform in some capacity or another. Bill Scott with the taser, to the extent that qualifies as reform. And he showed up in San Francisco when they were when the scandal had just happened with the racist texts that cops had been sending to each other, if you remember that.
Yes.
And Michelle Moore was assigned to clean up Rampart during the Rampart scandal that the Woody Harrelson movie is about. And Robert Arcos has been assigned to do outreach so that people living in L.A. Who are undocumented are less scared of deportation and work with the police.
People always bring up the Woody Harrelson movie, which I've never seen.
I haven't either.
I thought also Training Day, which is a much more famous movie, also takes heavily from... I know it's fictionalized, but...
And it's not called Rampart.
Okay, well, but nobody's ever seen the Woody Harrelson movie. That was their mistake.
No one has ever seen it, but everyone has vaguely heard of it. Everyone knows that that movie exists on some level.
Fair.
Anyway, make a guess. Guess now.
Michelle Moore.
I'm going to say Arcos.
Okay, great. Well, what are we putting on this?
I'll pick the next destination for where we record if I win.
Okay, great.
Arcos, I just feel like the city's never had a Latino chief, 50% Latino city.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Pretty egregious, I would say.
But again, they're both of Hispanic origin.
Of course.
I do not want to erase Michelle Moore's Basque heritage.
Don't do that. Yeah.
we have such a good guest. I'm so thrilled at who we got to talk to us today. Rudy Espinoza is executive director of LEARN, Leadership and Urban Renewal Network. And he and their group have really kind of been leading the charge with some other groups to decriminalize and fully legalize street vending.
Right. People may not know, but street vending is actually not legal in Los Angeles, has not been for a long time. So when you see fruit vendors on the street, things like that, they're all doing so at sometimes extreme
great personal risk. And Rudy has been trying to change that. The conversation was great. I learned a huge amount, and you can listen to it right now. Can I please welcome Rudy Espinoza to the podcast? You, Rudy, work at LEARN, not LEARN Network, because the N stands for network.
Correct.
Leadership and Urban Renewal Network.
Right.
So we want to talk about street vending specifically, but what are some other things that you guys are focused on lately?
You know what? A lot of the work that we've done today has been around, up until today, has been around micro entrepreneurs. In addition to policy work, we do economic development work. So we have two microfinance programs. We have a produce distribution enterprise that works with corner stores and convenience stores in low-income neighborhoods. And both the advocacy and the economic development work work together in synchronicity. Yeah. So our policy work has been focused on street vending. We've done work around land use and how it could sort of spur economic activity for local indigenous entrepreneurs. We've done work in doing research of how we can influence policy that that helps relax underwriting practices for small businesses in low-income neighborhoods can get capital to support their
work. Wow. A lot of what you guys do, from your name, goes back to how urban renewal actually devastated a lot of low-income communities, and you're kind of flipping that on its head and looking at policies that will actually lift those communities up, right?
Well, that's what we've been... It's funny because we always have debates with the team and the board about that
right.
word. That is,
yeah, it's a charged term.
It's a supercharged term. I'm an urban planner, so I've studied what urban renewal has done historically. The origins of the name for us was, can we reclaim it, much like right. a lot of yeah. communities have reclaimed terms. And so we grapple with it all the time. But yes, Scott, that is the purpose of our work, is to figure out, can we rethink how redevelopment and urban renewal happens in cities? That is the genesis of our organization, is we felt that a community development needed some freshness and creativity and innovation. And that's kind of how LEARN started, is a laboratory for that.
You guys have been working on legalizing street vending in LA. I think a question a lot of people have who don't know much about how the business of street vending works. So, for example, like most people who do street vending, how do they make money doing it? How does it normally work for a street vendor?
You know, it varies. So a lot of the entrepreneurs we work with are essentially sole proprietor business owners, where they have a product or a service that they offer, and it's a business. They are sort of the CEO of their business, and they have a product, and then they sell it, and that's how they maintain their families. There are some vendors that actually work for somebody else. So one of the things that we've looked at as a campaign and is looking at the ice cream, the paleteros, the ice cream cart vendors. Sometimes those entrepreneurs, those vendors, are not entrepreneurs. They actually work for somebody else. They get those products on consignment. The cart is not theirs. Essentially what they do is they go to a commissary or one of these places where they do have those carts, and then they essentially borrow the cart, they buy the product, and then they spend the day selling it. So I often say that it's almost like they're day laborers, because they do not own their means of production. That's one of the things that we've thought about as we've been advocating for a policy, is how do we protect those workers, and how do we create avenues for them to have their own cart and their own product, so they don't have to work through a middle person.
Right. That actually opens up another line of vulnerability for street vendors when they are actually selling product that they bought from somebody else. They owe essentially whatever the market value of the product is back to somebody if it gets confiscated by the police or whoever.
So what are some of the other issues that a street vendor faces typically?
So, you know, Learn has been working on this since like 2009, and some of the partners that we work with in the campaign have been working on it for that much or longer, in through various capacities and various fronts. The reason why we got into this is because we were doing research on entrepreneurs and, on the East Side, and we were really struck by these folks that were using the public right away to, you know, maintain their families. And we were surveying them and interviewing them, and a lot of them were saying, hey, you know, I do this work because I don't have a job. I can't find a job. I'm doing this work because the job that I do have is not enough for me to pay the bills in my household. And as we dug deeper and as we connected with other organizations that were also interested in this population, what surfaced was the fact that LA did not have a permit system for sidewalk vendors. So in addition to the struggle of trying to build a business and try to create a revenue stream for their households, a lot of these vendors were being criminalized.
So technically everybody doing this was doing it illegally.
Correct. And still to this day.
Okay.
So, and what was happening specifically, Hayes, to answer your question, is folks were getting citations. They were getting their equipment confiscated. They were getting citations that led to criminal offenses, which means misdemeanor charges, a lot of variety of things. They were getting arrested. Their debt was mounting up. And I think that these things are really important because when a vendor is out there selling stuff and they have their equipment, and maybe their equipment is a cooler or a cart, and it may not seem like a lot, but for these workers, that's everything. That's the way that they operate. These are their supplies. And when we've heard many stories of vendors, when something happens and the authorities come to confiscate their equipment, they're done for a week, 2 weeks, trying to figure out how to recoup some of these things so they could get back there into making some income.
And that would be especially threatening, I guess, for someone who was undocumented.
Totally.
Being cited and being arrested. It could easily get you deported. I'm sure that's happened.
Totally. And that is something that has been an important talking point as of late, as we've been, and it has been included in some of the policy discussions as of late that I'm happy to talk about. But yes, those are all important things. So when I talk about the ice cream, the pushcart vendor, and sort of some of the dynamics that they have to operate in is essentially working for a boss and paying, you know, getting their stuff on consignment, it's hard for them to figure out a different way because there is no other pathway. And I think that that's why we've been working really hard to create a system in the city where we are able to support these workers and support these entrepreneurs so they don't have to worry and they don't have to operate in fear.
How consistent is in enforcement of the law on this? Because I know, you know, for years, vendors more or less operate right in the open. And, you know, I'm sure cops drive by them all day long. Is it just the risk that someone will report them at some point and then the cops are obligated to come cite them or arrest them?
That's correct. Okay. So, you know, this is what makes it even harder for vendors because there's a lot of confusion as to what the law is. There's a lot of confusion with plenty of Angelenos when I say, oh, street vending is illegal. They're like, what? What
are you talking about? I see them all the time.
I see them all the time.
The umbrellas are very bright. I mean,
I see the guy with the rainbow umbrella selling fruit in front of the bank or my taco person in my neighborhood. Like, that's not, like, they're there. But what happens is the way that it's enforced is very reactionary. It could be a small business that doesn't like that person that week. It could be a council member that says, you know what, I want to clean the street up because I'm having visitors or I'm having a parade, which has happened.
So you have populations that are inherently among the most vulnerable Angelenos then being essentially at the whim of a specific individual, whether it's in the community or whether it's a specific law enforcement officer and just how they feel that day.
People with power, you know, and I think that it's not just.
Are the rules different for trucks?
The rules are different for trucks. So trucks are permitted and they have
to. It feels arbitrary to me.
It is arbitrary. So people always get confused with that. I'm like, okay, is this food trucks too? Food trucks are, when I'm talking about street vendors, I'm talking about vendors that are on the sidewalk.
Right.
Not on the roadway. And even though they're separated by an inch or a few centimeters, they are there's different codes that govern them. And so trucks just have to abide by the transportation code. They have to pay the parking meters. They have to, you know, make sure that they're, you know, taking care of the, if you're feeding the meter, you're not parking in red, you're good in the eyes of the city of Los Angeles. Of course, you have to go through the health department and get all your permits and all that stuff. But in the eyes of the city of LA, you're pretty good.
Feels like trucks came along a lot later than street vendors and were kind of sped through the process of getting permits. I don't know. It feels like...
That's because of who was looking for,
I know, because they sell like fancy grilled cheese or whatever. And
that's kind of a prestige sort of industry in its own way, I
guess. Well, you know, it's complicated because vendors and push carts have been around since even before the car.
Right.
You know, and there's our colleague Mark Vianatos, who's part of our campaign and been a partner for a long time. He always pulls these amazing photos from back in the day and in the early history of Los Angeles. And you see tamale vendors being where they have carts pushed by horses or pulled by horses. And it's amazing. And trucks have their own story, you know, and I think a lot of folks now, we think of food trucks as like, oh, it's the gourmet trucks, the grilled cheese truck, and, you know, Kogi Barbecue, of course, with mm-hmm. Roy Choi. But, you know, Roy is the first one to say that, hey, I'm on the shoulders of all these other,
right.
you know, lunch trucks that have been around for decades. And it's interesting because even those trucks have been sort of had some negative consequences as a result of the gourmet food truck scene.
Right.
And there's a lot of stories. And I know Gloria Molina at one time was really trying to outlaw food trucks because it was a growing movement and they were everywhere. And I remember a lot of the veteran lunch truck owners were just like, dude, we've been here for years. And now these cats are coming in from the outside with money and they're taking over the streets, being disrespectful. And now we're getting harassed
right.
too.
You know?
So anyways,
I think that, you bring up an interesting point about the fact that this is really part of Los Angeles's cultural heritage going back a very long time. And also, at the same time, Los Angeles is kind of an outlier in the way that we criminalize street vending now among major mm-hmm. large American cities. I don't think that New York, Chicago, San Francisco, cities like that have... just no process through which you can legally mm-hmm. vend on the street the way that Los Angeles has our system set up. So it's kind of an interesting situation that we find ourselves in with a large street vending population, but no legal way to street vend still.
Yeah, so out of the top 10 major cities in the country, the top 10 biggest cities, LA is the only one that does not have a permit system for sidewalk vendors.
Wow.
That doesn't mean that those cities have great programs. I mean, they all have like their own challenges and their own sort of restrictions that, you know, sometimes they're not good. But they have something. And it is ironic that this in the city of LA, we have nothing because it is part of our culture. And a lot of people enjoy vendors and patronize their businesses and... it's something that we need to fix.
So you guys have been working on this since 2009, getting legislation in place to have street vending be fully legal. Mm-hmm. There has finally been some action in the city council. Can you talk about some of the motions that have been going through recently and what you guys have been fighting for and against in terms of policy?
Yeah, so I should say that, so LEARN as an organization started about 2009, 2010. We connected with other organizations that were interested in this. And about 2011, let's say 2010, 2011, we formed the LA Street Vendor Campaign. So LEARN is one of many amazing organizations that are working to do this. You know, shout out to East LA Community Corporation that is the main organizer of vendors, the LA Food Policy Council that adds a lot of policy sort of insight, especially as it relates to food. Public Council Doug Smith has done a lot of heavy lifting on the analysis piece. There's a lot of players. In 2013, we started working on this together as a group. And then in 2013, we were finally able to get a council champion to introduce this policy.
Who was that?
Councilman Price and Councilman Wisad. And it was assigned to the Public Works and Economic Development Committee. I don't know if I should give you guys all those nerdy details, but essentially the cliff notes is that it was in these two committees and it was languishing and working really slow from 2013 to 2016. And what was happening is it was many committee meetings, and they came up with, like, let's do some hearings in the public. And there was, like, I think six cities hosted town halls on this.
Wow.
Our campaign did our own before that. We did five of our own with a lot of public input. And then the with committee, oh, well, I think we need more information. Let's ask the CLA to do another report. So there was a lot of punting from our perspective, and a lot of research and analysis over this time. In 2016, something happened. In November of 2016, something happened.
Yeah, that was a big shit. That really is when it feels like everything changed.
So what happened is after we were elected our current president, was that there was a different fervor at City Hall. And there was a lot of interest in figuring out how local leaders can stand up to Trump
and how they cannot be complicit in the deportation of
right. And so one of the things that happened was that the city council said, oh snap, one of the things we can do is begin to support street vendors because they're immigrant workers, let's do this. And so they began to mobilize. At that time it was in Public Works Committee that was chaired by Councilman Buscaino. Buscaino's staff jumped up and said, okay, let's put this something together that's good and we could get it to city council. They worked really fast. So I think it was November the president was elected. In December, the final committee happened.
Oh, my God.
They pushed it out of the committee, and then it went to the full city council in January 2017, and then another hearing in February. So it happened really fast.
Okay.
What happened was two things. The first thing that happened was the city council voted to decriminalize street vending. And that was in direct response to Trump's executive order that prioritized sort of criminal immigrants for deportation. And the way that it was written, it basically said that if you have a chargeable criminal offense, so let's say, Hayes, you're from you're from El Salvador. Uh-huh.
Why is that funny?
So you're undocumented, and let's say you're vending, you have one of these push carts, and you're selling ice cream, and you get a citation under the code, Section 42. It's not a misdemeanor, but it could become a misdemeanor if you don't go to court right away.
Yeah.
So in that case, because you got that citation, you could technically be lined up for deportation under the executive order. Mm. So the city council voted to decriminalize street vending, which means that you cannot get that type of offense, and they basically made it an administrative citation.
So the citation, does it keep getting more and more expensive if you don't come in? It just never becomes a misdemeanor.
Correct.
Okay. Because I remember at the time the decriminalization happened, I think I saw a tweet about it and was just like, oh, great. You know, problem solved. Right. Like, no one's even getting tickets for this anymore. But it's still a very expensive proposition to get cited over. It's still an expensive thing.
So when folks, and that's something we tell vendors a lot, it's still illegal. Right. You're still going to get citations. Decriminalization simply means...
It's not legalization.
Exactly. Yeah. The second thing that the city council voted on during this time is early 2017. They said, okay, we're going to decriminalize street vending. We're all down for that. You know, we want to stand up to Trump. The second thing they did is like, oh, I guess we should move forward on the city council on legalizing vending and creating the permit program. And so they voted in favor of that. And so that was February 2017. There was one joint committee of several months later. And then we finally got to, what month are we in? May 2018. So last month, they finally met again as a city council. And they voted to approve a framework, approve a program.
Right.
And so where we are today, for folks that are interested, like a little bit lost, where we are today is we are now waiting for the city attorney to draft an ordinance based on the proposal that was approved.
Okay. And there was a lot of back and forth over that proposal, over the framework. That's what kind of slowed everything down.
Yes.
And the big sticking point was what?
So there was several, but the big one that the campaign was worried about was what we were calling the business veto.
The business veto. I remember some people being arrested outside of City Hall protesting the business veto.
So essentially what the city council proposed, the committee proposed, was, well, we need to give a voice to property owners. So what we will do is give them a say in whether or not a vendor can get a permit. And we were astonished by that, because we don't believe the public right-of-way should be governed strictly by property owners.
And at first, it was that the business owners would be able to say no.
Correct. Right?
they would be able to give the final no on whether or not somebody would be allowed to vend in front.
In addition to a lot of limitations about where people could vend in the first place.
So there was a lot of location restrictions that in the first cut that we saw from the chief legislative analyst's office were essentially what we thought were basically copy pasted from the bike rack from the newsstand ordinance. Like, this looks familiar. Well, vendors are not newsstands, you know. It's different. Right. So there was also issues around the special vending districts that they were proposing. There's an arbitrary limit to vending of two vendors per block that we were worried about, only because some blocks are big and they could accommodate more, and some of them are much smaller and they can't really accommodate any. We have been asking the city council to think about how we can respect the built environment, the diversity of the built environment, and how we create a policy that's citywide and not just arbitrarily say two vendors per block.
And it's interesting too, because it's interesting that you say that, because some places can accommodate more vendors and some places naturally you would want more vendors. And there were some restrictions in there in the city council's proposed legislation that would prevent vending outside of Staples Center, for example.
Right, and two vendors a block outside of Staples, there's like two vendors every, like,
gonna wait know,
every
like
10 feet.
Like, 5-hour line for a hot dog.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's crazy. It's not enough.
Right, yeah, I agree.
So the business veto, who was supporting that? Who was against it?
So, man, that meeting was epic. So the campaign, there was many things we were not happy about, and we decided that the business veto was one of the most the things we needed to really address, because we were really worried about that. And we focused a lot of energy to educate the council on making sure that they understood what that meant. And on that day at the hearing, essentially there was two fronts, right? Kern Price and Council and WESAD were advancing the notion that let's advance a proposal that does not have a business veto.
I saw Kern Price made a great point about it, which was that basically business owners could extort vendors.
Correct.
Could say, I'm going to veto you being out here unless, I don't know, you pay me off, right, like some of the share.
Crazy thing is, Hayes, is that happens today. If you go to like the Piñata District on Olympic, mm-hmm. A lot of those vendors pay rent.
Wow.
In order to not get enforcement called on them.
And in order for the business owner to not call the cops.
Whoa.
So that is already happening. So Kern Price said that was important. The other front was led by, was Councilman Blumenfeld, mm-hmm. Who felt that his committee advanced a proposal that he thought was good. The Economic Development Committee changed it, and he wanted to keep the initial proposal that his committee...
Which is his committee?
Public Works.
Got it.
Since in all this time, Councilman Buscaino was no longer the chair of the Public Works Committee, and Blumenfeld was put in that process.
Wow.
Yeah, so I think Blumenfeld was kind of representing the other side. And it was Blumenfeld, Bonin...
Koretz.
And there was another... It was on that side.
Okay.
And so what happened was that council president...
Englander,
of course, Englander. yes. So they called the vote and for that proposal, and it lost. I think the vote tally was 6-9. And then...
very unusual.
No, it wasn't 6-9. So was it?
I think it was in the final vote. I think Blumenfeld put forward a motion to say, let's consider both of these options for a little longer.
Exactly.
And then the council voted 6-9.
I think that's what I read.
Final vote was 11 to 4, I remember.
11 to 4 in favor of the other proposal. Yeah. So after Blumenfeld's vote was called, they lost. They didn't have enough votes to move forward. Yeah. And then Council President Weston said, well, let's go for the other one without the business veto. And it won 11-4. And I think a lot of us were really shocked.
Right.
With what happened, I think it was...
That it won. Yeah, sure. Well, you've been doing this for 7-8 years.
Well, yeah. And then also, like, there was so much discussion and the members were talking to each other and whispering to each other. And there was so much activity. Right. I haven't seen that much activity in a long time at the council.
Herb Wesson does not do this. Yeah. He doesn't bring motions that the council is not unanimous on. He doesn't have these things out in public.
This level of back and forth is almost unheard of. And also it's amazing that we're even talking about, you know, 6-9, 11-4. Normally it's 15-0.
Maybe you get one against for
15-0. I mean, so they voted 11-4, and then I'm like, what? And then I look, I think I looked at Doug, who was across the hall, and I was like, what the hell? Like, that's it? And I was like, I guess that happened. And it was like really quiet, and the vendors, which is another topic, but the vendors, half of them didn't have translation equipment, so they're kind of like looking at us like, okay, was that good?
They're waiting for you to cheer, but yeah, you're not, we're like, ready like to
still,
do that.
Still processing. It was just crazy. But in retrospect, I loved the discussion.
Great.
Like, I loved the activity of the members.
Yeah. That would be so cool if that happened more often.
Oh, my God, I
People
know.
People might go.
I love the Council President West, and much props to him for calling the vote, because he was there saying, guys, we should really come together. We usually come together on stuff.
Right.
I'm going to just give everybody a fair shot. Blumenfeld, go ahead. You know, let's call your vote, and let's call Price's vote and see who wins. And I liked it. It's democracy. Yeah. Yeah. And I love the members talking to each other.
Right.
Of going over there and saying, hey, you know, like, this is my opinion about this. And let's talk about it. It was good. And maybe it happens in other rooms, but it didn't. It usually doesn't happen.
Oh, I'm sure it happens somewhere. It just doesn't happen where we can see it normally. Yeah, yeah, no, yeah, that's a very exciting thing to be a part of.
So we're waiting for the city attorney now, okay. And it's going to be, they put an urgency clause, so they have 60 days to write an ordinance, and it's going to go back to council. We are worried, it's going to be a big, I mean, it's going to be epic.
Yeah. So people, you need people to show up for that.
Big time. And we need people to get involved now, because it's going to be a big battle, and some of the members are already saying, hey, you thought that was something, it's going to be worse when we do the final vote. This next vote is going to be the final vote.
Yeah.
This is the one that is actually accepting the final language of the legislation.
Exactly. It's going to make it into a law. So
do you have any sense of who the swing votes might be, who you would be worried about losing?
I think that there's important players that I wish we could work with, that I intend to work with. You know, I think like Councilman Bonin. I'm a big fan of Councilman Bonin.
Okay. But you would have to get him on, because he voted against.
He voted against.
Yeah. I was surprised by that.
Yeah, I mean, he deals with a lot of issues, and I understand. But, I mean, he's super progressive on a lot of things, and I think he could be a really great ally. And I think that there's room, you know?
Sure.
I think Councilwoman Martinez is a champion for so many things, and she supported the proposal. I think she has a lot of very valid concerns about prostitution and sort of how vendors relate to that in her district. I think
really?
We should accommodate that. We should think about that and make sure that we have good policy to protect those folks that are being victimized.
Right.
So I think she's a really important vote. Councilman Rue actually is somebody that has stepped up to talk about what we've been, this is not the right word, but we've talked about amnesty for vendors. And what he's really concerned about, which is justified, is what happens to all the vendors that have mounted much debt in the past.
That's a great point.
And can we,
great point.
Can we go back in time to say, hey guys, we've legalized it now, we're going to expunge or forgive some of these fines.
Wow.
So Councilman Rue, I'm not sure if there's been any activity on that, but he's brought that up, and I think that's an amazing point.
Yeah, I'm very impressed by that. I mean, maybe it's not fair, but I don't normally think of him as being the one leading the charge on those kind of issues. That's great.
So out of curiosity, we have a proposal right now. The attorney is crafting the final language. Are you, as of today, happy with where the language sits? Are you trying to get additional changes into the final legislation, or where's Learn sitting right now?
So, you know, the campaign is concerned. We want to make sure that the business veto stays away. We are worried about some of the language around the proposal for special vending districts. We want to make sure that it's not used as a tool for excluding vendors, but it's a tool that we can use for interesting places like Hollywood Boulevard or like, you know, Staples Center, where there's areas that are different that require different rules, but maybe allows vendors, or, you know, we want respectable, honorable rules.
Does the framework currently say that Hollywood Boulevard, for example, is off limits?
No.
Oh,
but
okay.
But I think that
was an earlier.
I think that was an earlier thing. But okay. But I do think that there is the idea is that special vending districts would be layered on top of these areas, and we want to make sure that whatever tool that is, that it honors vendors and it's not exclusionary, that it's guided by public safety and health reasons, not just discriminatory practices. We're worried about the two vendors per block limit that is still there. We want to make sure there is a little bit of concern. the whole everything I told you guys about decriminalization, there is some concern that that might come back, that the council may say, hey, administrative citations that we're using are not enough to enforce vendors, and we need to bring back the hammer, and we don't want that. And so we're also monitoring that to make sure that vendors are not criminalized.
So you're looking at whatever whatever tool is going to end up being used to enforce these new regulations is going to be still one that prioritizes administrative citations and does not lead to the criminal justice system.
Councilman Buscaino requested a report on how the administrative citations are working now. So I think he's, you know, he's interested in that. And I get that. I get that for sure. We should totally learn, but we shouldn't. These folks are not criminals.
Right.
They're working people that want an opportunity, and we need to do everything possible to make sure that they know that they're part of our city.
And I think it's important to bring up that they're often victims of crime. In the last few months, there have been some very high-profile beatings, robberies of vendors, and if they don't feel like they're fully legalized or decriminalized, then they might be less likely to go through the justice system, especially
if
they're not
documented.
A
vendor today, you're not going to call the cops and say, hey, I see this shady thing on the corner over here. Like, and so this is Jane Jacobs, lies on the street. This is this is about engaging people that are good people, you know?
That was great.
Thanks, Rudy. That was
thank
really fantastic.
You, Rudy. Thank you for listening to the show. We will be back recording next time from the Dolby Theater, maybe, on Hollywood Boulevard.
You don't get to choose unless you win.
That's right. Okay. Bye.